let's talk now about how to make shared expectations more specific. Now, in the last section, we talked about how to deal with the design problem that we often face with shared expectations, that those expectations get turned into a misguided instrument. In this section, we're going to tackle the challenge of specificity, the challenge that in too many cases, we have an expectation, but it's not detailed enough to really give people guidance as to what to do to improve their practice. So we're going to talk in this section about how to provide that detail and actually put those shared expectations in writing with enough specificity that they're useful. So to make your framework language more useful in those feedback conversations, the key is, of course, to make it more specific, to go beyond something like a buzzword like student engagement. This year, we're focusing our walkthroughs on student engagement. We really want to see more student engagement. Well, you can repeat the buzzword engagement all day long, but it's not going to lead to a lot of improvement if nobody knows what you mean by that, or if everyone thinks they know what you mean by it, but everyone has their own definition and you're really not on the same page. You can repeat till you're blue in the face, we're focusing on assessment this year. But if nobody knows what you truly mean by assessment and everyone has their own definition, it's not going to get us anywhere. We could do the same thing with instructional purpose. If we don't know what we mean by that, if we're not specific enough, it's not going to lead to improvement. But if you have started with a buzzword, that's a perfectly great place to start. If purpose or assessment or engagement is your starting point, you're in the right place and you can move forward. And what we're basically going to do here is go from a buzzword, you know, a single term, to more of a specific shared definition, and ultimately to a leveled rubric. And in the last section, we talked extensively about the characteristics of a high quality instructional framework that takes the form of a leveled rubric. And we contrasted that to other ways of describing shared expectations. And you saw just how powerful it is to have a true leveled rubric where the distinction between different levels of performance is obvious. Even if you're only observing once, even if you have limited evidence to work with, you can see it because the description of what you're looking for that level of performance is so clear. So here's what I'd like to ask you to do for some big improvement priority that you have in mind. Maybe you are working on purpose or engagement or assessment or, you know, some buzzword, some priority for improvement. Rate the specificity of your shared expectations at the moment. Is it a pure buzzword where there's really, you know, we've said that it's a priority, but we haven't really said what it means? Is there a shared meaning kind of tacitly? People know what you mean, but there may not be a formal definition. Is there a formal written definition? That would be a 3 on our scale here. Is there a rubric? If you've already gone as far as to develop a rubric, then you're in great shape. And finally, level 5, is that rubric a true qualitative rubric, like we talked about in the last section, with clear qualitative distinctions between the levels of performance? It's not just, you know, do the same thing at the previous level, but more often or to a greater extent. There's actually a tangible difference between those levels of performance. So being more specific is going to pay off because it's going to give people a roadmap to improvement. So rather than say, well, I got a 2 and I don't like that, I wish I was a 3, people can actually look at the rubric and say, here is where I need to go next. That detail is built in to the rubric. So to get more specific, before we talk about how to do that, how to get more specific, I want to talk about what we don't need to worry about. And I see often when districts are using low quality instructional frameworks, they're using low quality instruments that focus too much on a score and focus too much on inter-rater reliability. What they try to do is they try to say, well, what does it look like to the observer? We call this observability bias. What does good practice look like to the observer? And then how can we get all of our observers to score that same practice in the same way? And again, we can practice with a video, we can get people watching the same video and trying to score it the same way. And then if there's disagreement, people can talk about it and try to get on the same page in terms of their score. I want to suggest that that is actually a colossal waste of time, because what's missing is the clarity of understanding with the teacher. If the rubric itself has nothing but 1, 2, 3, 4 on it, it doesn't have the descriptions of a true qualitative rubric, then we're missing the opportunity for improvement that we would have if we built those in and created that roadmap for growth. So I think we've really got to get away from this idea of scoring a brief observation. I don't know where we got this idea that teaching is like a reality show or a singing competition that can just be scored as a discrete performance. When you go into a classroom, what you are observing is a lesson. You know, it is to some extent, a self-contained microcosm of the teacher's practice, but it's not really self-contained. What you are seeing in any given observation has a great deal to do with what the teacher did at the beginning of the year, what the teacher did at the beginning of the unit, what the teacher did at the beginning of the week, and it doesn't really make sense to evaluate an individual lesson completely by itself and give it a score. It only has meaning within a larger context. And it's only by talking with the teacher that we can get a sense of what that context is and then make decisions about where to focus next to help that teacher improve. So I really dislike the idea of inter-rater reliability because I think it treats teaching too much as these discrete performances like, you know, singing a song on American Idol or one of those other reality shows where there's a brief performance and that's all you're judged on and you're judged with a score and there's not necessarily a rubric or any kind of evidence-based alignment between that score and the actual performance. We've got to get away from that paradigm because it is the wrong paradigm for teaching. And instead, what we've got to do is look for the insider's view of practice. We don't need to worry so much about what it looks like to an observer to have exemplary practice. We need to look at what it looks like to the teacher from the inside. If we're going to focus on teacher decision-making and improve teacher decision-making, we've got to let go of that observability bias focus. So what does it look like from the inside? What are the key dimensions of the practice? And then within each key dimension, or as we said in the Danielson framework, the components of each domain, what are the various levels of performance? I thought I would give an example of sticking to a pacing guide here of both the outsider's view and the insider's view. If we're thinking about teachers sticking to the pacing guide from an observer's standpoint, from an administrator standpoint, maybe a central office administrator standpoint, we want teachers to follow the pacing guide that the district has established. And we're focused on our needs as that outside observer. So we might think something like, well, teachers should just keep up with the district pacing guide so that, you know, they don't fall behind. And of course, they need to make sure that every student masters the essential knowledge and skills, you know, bring everybody along, use assessment, don't leave anybody behind. But really, you've got to stick with the pacing guide. That's the outsider's view. And teachers have that outsider's view, of course, but they actually have a much more nuanced and detailed view. Because to make the decisions that they have to make, they have to consider more factors. So the insider's view of a pacing guide might go something like this. Well, I need to finish up this unit by Friday to stick with the pacing guide, and I need to finish up this lesson by the end of the period, but I'm not quite ready to move on. If I move on from this activity right now, I'm going to lose some of the students who really aren't getting it yet, and I think I can get them there. So that teacher in that moment has to make a very real decision of do I do give some more examples and work with students on this concept more, or do I move on? It is a very real dilemma. And if we oversimplify it with our outsider's view and just say, well, you need to stick to the pacing guide, we're missing the real crux of teaching practice and trying to bypass that crucial set of decisions that the teacher is making. So if you want to develop an insider's view of a particular practice like pacing, ask yourself, what are the key dimensions of the decision that the teacher is making? And what would be some good and bad examples of decisions that teachers could make? One of the easiest ways to develop your rubrics and to develop your shared expectations is to look at what people are doing and make notes to yourself of, you know, what makes sense that people are doing and what seems kind of dumb that people are doing. If you see people doing things that make a lot of sense, those are probably going to be your higher levels of performance. And the things that don't work so well, that seem kind of illogical or kind of ill-conceived to you, probably are going to be your lower levels of performance. So you don't have to think these up on your own. Look at what people are actually doing and look for ways to operationalize and define and clearly describe the best of what you see as well as the worst of what you see. And that can go in your lower categories. So if we were to break the topic of pacing down into some key dimensions, I might come up with things like, you know, the deadline, when do I need to be done with this? Where is the majority of my class? So what's kind of the average understanding? Who are the exceptions to that average? You know, my students who are ready to move on fast or who need a lot of extra time to get it. We might break that down into the dimension of interventions and, you know, what we can do to target attention on students who need more assistance. And consequences, like what happens if we move on and don't close all the gaps for a particular student? Is that going to come up later? Or is this kind of a peripheral topic and we can let it go? Teachers are probably thinking of all or most of those things when they're making a pacing decision. So if we look at the insider's perspective, it's far more detailed and nuanced than that outsider's view of, are you sticking with the pacing guide or not? And of course, teachers will be happy to share their insider's view in your feedback conversations. So feedback conversations are a great way to get a sense of what teachers are already thinking are the key dimensions of a particular practice. But when you make that thinking public, when you put it in writing, when you articulate it into a rubric and share it with everyone, the opportunities for improvement go through the roof. So this is an incredible opportunity for us to start by seeing what the current state of practice is, you know, look at positive and negative examples, and then break that down into those specific categories and specific levels of performance. So let's look at some maybe real world sounding examples of what we might notice in terms of pacing that work and that don't work for each of these components. So first, for the deadline, when do I need to move on? Some bad examples, time runs out, teacher abruptly ends the activity, or extends the week, the unit by a week because, you know, a few students need some more time. You know, if we're kind of blunt in our approach to making those deadline decisions, it's not gonna be very effective. In the middle here, I have teacher checks for understanding with 10 minutes remaining. Okay, that's probably a good practice. And these don't have to be perfect or things that the teacher should do all the time. They're just positive and negative examples that you're gonna note as you observe and talk with more and more teachers about, say, their pacing. When it comes to the dimension of where the average understanding of the class is, of course, simply asking everybody if they understand is not going to be a very effective check for understanding. Using a quiz or assessment would be more effective. And of course, relying on students to just kind of raise their hand if they know the answer or if they don't understand, that's not going to give us reliable evidence, reliable information. And for, let's see, and then for a final example, moving on from pacing, what if we were to consider the practice of reaching non-responsive students? And we'll leave this one as a little bit of a thought exercise here. If you are currently engaging in virtual schooling, right? If school is closed or you have some students who are learning from home and just are non-responsive, you have students who are not logging in, not doing their work, you're not hearing from them. What are the key dimensions of teacher decision-making when teachers are thinking about how to reach those students who aren't participating in virtual learning? Think for a second about how you would break that down into specific areas or components of that practice. And then think about what you've seen teachers do already this year in terms of effectively reaching or of failing to reach their non-responsive students. This is how you can start to get more specific with a framework. So you might start with simply the title of reaching non-responsive students. You might say, hey, everybody, we really need to focus this month on how we're going to engage our students that we're not hearing from at all. So it starts with kind of an undefined expectation, just a single word, a buzzword, a statement, a title. And then we get more specific about that. We break that down into components, and then we start to look for examples of varying quality, both good and bad. And then we can start to arrange those into a rubric. Make sense? This is doable. This is doable fairly easily and fairly casually. You do not have to have a committee for it. You can start right away in your feedback conversations. I did want to make a little side note here about specific teaching moves, because I see this happening a lot when instructional leaders really believe strongly in particular teaching practices. It's not that any specific practice is inherently good or inherently bad. You know, there are some practices that just often are a bad idea and others that are often a good idea, but really it's about context and quality, right? You can use a great technique effectively or poorly. And when it comes to improvement, what we really need to be focused on is the teacher's thinking and decision-making and how they're implementing that strategy. Our big opportunity for school improvement is largely around teacher judgment. If we can improve teacher professional judgment when we are in the classroom and are talking with the teacher, that's going to have huge carryover effects when we're not in the classroom. And then just a final evidence point, we can't really assess how often something happens when we're not there. So we don't need to focus too much on frequency. When it comes to specific techniques, often these are introduced from professional development or from professional reading, and great books like Teach Like a Champion. There are lots of great specific techniques that we could emphasize as instructional leaders. And you probably have some strategies that you prefer, that you're always suggesting that teachers try and nudging them to use more. But we have to keep in mind that there is always more than one way to accomplish a given instructional purpose. And if teachers choose a different way than you do, that is okay. What we want to look at is what the deeper practice truly looks like, and that insider's view of practice. So to get more specific in our frameworks, again, we take that insider's view. What does it look like from the inside? Not what does it look like to an observer who may not be able to see a lot of the assessment and the thinking and the planning that the teacher's doing. Some of those kind of beneath the iceberg, beneath the surface of the water dimensions of practice. What are the key dimensions of the practice? And then what might some different examples of different levels of performance look like? Now, when you are breaking a practice down into its components or the key dimensions, I want to be clear that we're not talking about steps. We are not talking about step one, write the purpose on the board, step two, pass out the papers. Like, we're not talking about the steps that teachers go through, because that's kind of behind us. Like, teachers have already moved past that point when we're talking about these these improvement opportunities and what different levels of practice look like. So if we're talking about the characteristics of a practice, like using appropriate instructional groupings, we might think about components like the structure of the number of students in a group and how that fits the instructional purpose. We might think about the grouping method. We might think about what data we're using to group students. We might look at how the teacher is changing groupings as student needs change and new assessment information becomes available. And we might look at how the teacher explicitly teaches students how to work in specific types of instructional groupings. But what we're not going to do is say, here is step one for having students work in groups. Here is step two, here is step three. Because that, of course, is going to vary, and it's probably not what teachers need from us. We really need to be looking at the quality distinctions. So we first break it into components, and then we look at the levels of performance, which we'll talk about in the next section. For now, go ahead and get your journal out and reflect on these two questions. First, how have goals such as scoring, observability, and inter-rater reliability prevented us in your organization from getting at the insider's view of practice? In almost every organization that has made any attempt at instructional leadership, there has been an attempt that has been too observer-focused and has perhaps suffered from observability bias rather than taking that insider's view of practice. So push yourself to see if you can think of an example in your organization's recent history. And then second, think of a current priority in your organization, either your district or your school. How specific are your shared expectations right now? And wherever you are is fine, because now you know where to go next. Is it just a buzzword? There's really no shared understanding at all. It's just a label. Is there a shared meaning that's been established through conversation, but maybe nothing has been put in writing? Or is it already in writing and ready to be turned into a rubric? Or maybe you already have a rubric that describes different levels of performance, and you're ready to turn it into a rubric that has true qualitative distinctions between those levels of performance and take it beyond just the frequency or extent kind of rubric. Reflect on a particular priority and rate that according to that 5-point scale there. And when you've done that, you're ready to move on to the next section.